Hi, I'm Nigel Campbell, editor of Jazz in the Islands magazine, with another episode of Island Jazz Chat, a podcast featuring conversations with Caribbean jazz and pan jazz musicians based in the islands and the diaspora. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Island Jazz Chat. Today I have the pleasure of speaking to Trinidad jazz trumpeter and Creole soul, Etienne Charles. Hi Etienne, how are you doing?
Nigel, always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for being a part of this.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, on this podcast, we normally kind of do a kind of retrospective of the careers of our Caribbean jazz artists and things, right? You and I have a connection in that. I've written a long piece about your musical and recording career. But I'm very keen in what you've been doing in the last year or two post-pandemic. And, of course, one of the standout productions that you've done was the San Juan Hill and New York Story. Tell me about the genesis of that and in terms of your composition, how you got to tell that story in music.
It's a great question. Well, for many people, you know, the pause caused by the global shutdown during what I still see as a pandemic, it gave people a lot of time to think, conceptualize. In my case, it gave me a lot of time to think and react to different parts of history and current events that had spoken to me over the years. Now, San Juan Hill is a neighborhood in New York City that has a very interesting history because it was one of the first predominantly black neighborhoods, predominantly free black neighborhoods in the United States of America at a time when America was going through rapid changes and there was a lot of migration to New York City. Many of those migrants came from Many of the black migrants came from the English-speaking Caribbean, the Spanish-speaking Caribbean, the French-speaking Caribbean, as well as from the south of the United States, the Carolinas, Virginia. And it was an interest. This was before Harlem even became Harlem. Black New York is very interesting because it starts when New York is Dutch. And it starts with Africans being employed to guard the coast from indigenous invasions. That's where, so they first settled down on Wall Street, and they continuously moved. They were continuously moved because it wasn't by choice. And so they were continuously moved. Ended up in Greenwich Village, which, you know, the reason you hear David Rutter say, "I can hear roar and lion," right? I can still hear lion roar in Greenwich Village. That line in that song talks about the fact that the Village Vanguard, which is the most famous jazz club in the world, before it was exclusively a jazz club, it was an African diasporal entertainment spot. Mm-hmm. And many of the acts were Calypsonians. Yeah. Roaring Lion.
What year was there. This? This was in what year?
This is the 1920s.
Basically during the Harlem Renaissance period, that kind of...
Yeah, but you see, the Harlem Renaissance is interesting because Harlem only becomes a thing for black people in the 1920s.
Okay.
It's because of a guy named Peter. Now, before you had Harlem, you had San Juan Hill. Mm. Before you had San Juan Hill, you had the Tenderloin, which was a little bit south of them. Before you had the Tenderloin, I mean, you had Hell's Kitchen as well. You had the Tenderloin, but then you had Greenwich Village. Mm. So that's where that line comes from in that song. Now, San Juan Hill was something that I was always just interested in because my first year at Juilliard, we did a concert, the music of Herbie Nichols, and I had no idea who Herbie Nichols was. But I know the name Nichols because we have that name in Trinidad.
Correct, yeah.
And so I was like, man, it's really interesting. This black musician, you don't really hear Nichols as an American name. Like, they don't know about Nichols Plantation.
True, right? Yeah.
So come to find out, the Herbie Nichols parents were from Trinidad. Mm. And so we played that music. And, you know, a lot of people talk about Herbie Nichols' music being influenced by Thelonious Monk. Like, so a lot of times people say that. But there's a difference. And so when I realized doing the research to do that concert and then digging in further, I realized that Nichols and Monk, it wasn't the fact that Nichols was influenced by Monk specifically. Of course, he probably was. But it was the fact that they were influenced by living in a place where there were so many different types of people that communicated in different ways, that listened to different musics. And the common denominator for me of Monk and Nichols' music is the bouncing melody, which is a bouncing melody in tribute to a Caribbean aesthetic of melody and music, which I know that Monk heard as a child growing up in San Juan Hill, being best friends with people like Denzel Best, who was Barbadian, and being close, and being in a neighborhood where you have West Indian immigrants, like Russell Prokop's parents were West Indian. There's so many West Indian migrants that were specifically in San Juan Hill at that time. And so, for me, that's when I started digging more into it. And then when Monk's book came out by Robin D.G. Kelly in, I think it was 2011. I read that book. I never forget. December 2011. It was the year that Ralph McDonald died. And I was in Tobago on a vacation by myself after Christmas. And I sat down and I read Kelly's book. And in the first couple paragraphs, first couple chapters of the book, it's a description of San Juan Hill and who was there. And it was my first time reading actual documentation of a neighborhood where there's these significant West Indian contributors.
Effectively part of a diaspora that had been built in.
And, you know, people always talk about Brooklyn being...
That's a modern phenomenon.
But you had Harlem with West Indians. I mean, you have two West Indian writers in the cadre of Harlem Renaissance writers.
Eric Waldron and Claude McKay.
You have Claude McKay and you have Eric Waldron.
There you go.
Right?
I read my books
more
in school.
And there are more if you go down, if you really dig into the list, right? So I'm like, well, we've been shortchanged. So that's really when I started digging into San, because Kelly really brilliantly in this book shows what San Juan Hill was and why Monk became what he was as a musician based on that experience. And knowing the story of Bemsha Swing, Bemsha is about Barbados.
Bemsha.
And that's kind of why we recorded Green Chimneys. It was Monty Alexander, who was a dear friend and mentor, who was in my apartment in New York playing Aaron Deal's piano. And he was like, you know, my Monk's music bounces because he was from San Juan Hill. And at that time, being a jazz musician meant you had to be able to communicate rhythmically with Caribbean people because he's trying to sell tickets. And so in the you go forward to the 50s, you start seeing all these big bands playing calypsos. It's common knowledge now that Harry Belafonte's first band was a jazz group. With Charlie Parker in it, with Max Roach in it. There's recordings of Charlie Parker playing Little Suede Shoes. Rex Stewart recorded a tune called San Juan Hill. Benny Carter recorded Echoes of Sound. Like, there's so many things that tie that neighborhood together, and it hadn't really been talked about properly. So I decided I wanted to do this piece, and I reached out to Lincoln Center because Lincoln Center is there. And before Lincoln Center was there, it was San Juan, and so they were very receptive to the idea. And I told them I wanted it to be a multimedia thing so that they could see people and see, because one of the things I always want to do with my music is make sure the music paints a portrait of people.
Yes.
You know, Damn Lorraine for me is a musical portrait.
From Carnival, Volume 1.
You know, One for Senor is a portrait. They're musical, but they're portraits. And so San Juan Hill, in a really simple sense, was a multimedia portrait of that neighborhood.
One of the things that I'd recognized very early on, aside from doing your research and doing what I call your Trinidad albums, which are Folklore and Kaiso, in Creole Soul, you kind of expanded your vision. You went beyond. You went to Haiti and you went to the French Islands to get their rhythms and that kind of stuff. But critically, and certainly, and I've said this openly and I've said it a million and one times, Carnival, Song of a People, Volume 1, I think it's the greatest piece of music that ever been created by Trinidadian. I can say that. It's really good. It has impact. It has power. It's a story that is very, very important to the Trinidad cultural space. But you, as a... more than just a simply an academic, but as a musician who's learned, and it's the thing that I remember in my essay about you, is that you are part of a milieu that looked at academic excellence as like a norm. It's going to Juilliard, you're in a space that we're really among people who are just the best, as it was. So you've been able to do your research, and there's this concept of the Black Atlantic, so that you're able to connect Harlem and San Juan Hill to Trinidad, to Port of Spain, to Port-au-Prince, and recognize that we are part of a larger Americas. You've done it with your Creole Christmas albums and things. But I'm keen to understand, beyond the reception that you got from the New York Philharmonic or Lincoln Center, what was that creation process? Because what exactly were you trying to paint in this multimedia portrait of San Juan Hill, a Caribbean diaspora space?
So when I started the conceptualization of the piece, I didn't know exactly what it was going to be. I just knew I wanted music. I knew I wanted to show visuals. I knew I wanted words. And I wanted words of actual residents, people from the neighborhood. Because it's pretty clear now that the history of San Juan Hill has been presented a certain way because of things like West Side Story. You know, they talk about the Irish and the Puerto Ricans, etc., right? Mm-hmm. You know, art has this way of changing people's knowledge or perception, because a lot of times people focus just on what that work of art tells them.
Yes.
And not much else. Mm-hmm. When you talk about places like San Juan, most people will refer to West Side Story.
Yes.
You look at West Side Story, mm-hmm. almost everybody in the movie mm-hmm. is white.
Yeah, and Puerto Rican. Yeah, it was all the Latin, Puerto Rican, and that's the American republics. Mm.
And I say Euro descendant simply because that's what it is. Right? So when I was like, I definitely want to show that San Juan Hill was not just that. So that was my initial. But then as I started digging, I'm realizing it's all these. And, you know, I'm being a musician, it puts me in a unique space as a researcher, because I have the tools of people that I've interacted with as a musician. So one of the first people I called was Buddy Williams. Mm. He's a great drummer. One of the most New York people I know, who's a West Indian. You know, him and Happy Williams are cousins.
I did not know that.
So Buddy put me on to, so Buddy Williams went to this high school in New York, it's called High School of Music and Art. Now it's known as LaGuardia School for the Arts.
Back then it was High School. Is that where Fame was?
Fame, exactly.
Yes, yeah. Mm.
And so I was like, yo, was there anybody that you went to school with that was from San Juan Hill? Because that's where the school, well, back then it was uptown. Now it's in opposite Juilliard.
Mm.
But he said, yeah, man, you should call Rashid Ali. I reached out to Rashid. Rashid grew up in the same building that the Charleston basically was formed in. And he only realized that after we started working on this project. He looked at the address of the Jungle's Casino and realized it was the building he was living in.
He was in. Okay.
Now, Rashid Ali also grew up with Toot Monk, which is Thelonious Monk Jr.
Mm-hmm.
He grew up in Monk's house.
Wow.
This is a Rashid Ali, same Ali's roti in Toronto.
Yeah.
As Rashid Ali, the saxophone player from San Juan Hill.
Wow.
Immediate connection. And because I'm a Trinidadian, Rashid and I buck up a certain way because he's very familiar with this culture. He's been coming here for years. And he's writing a book, actually, about the San Juan Hill experience. So I was able to, in addition to doing all the research and doing a lot of New York Times research, get people's stories. So I went and I met people. Because I wanted to channel all my pieces like in the spirit of San Jose Suite and in the spirit of Carnival, the sound people. I always try to channel the indigenous experience as well as the Afro-descendant experience.
Yes, you go all the way back. Yeah.
So to dig into the indigenous experience, I reached out to one of the great indigenous musicians and artists in New York right now, whose father, come to find out, was from San Juan Hill and was one of the gang leaders who Benny in West Side Story is modeled
after
this actual man.
Wow.
Was able to go sit in his house, and he's a musician. He played conga drums, he sang, played music together. He told me the whole story of growing up. He was born in Puerto Rico. And so hearing these voices, and then I met with another great New York historian who has since passed away, Cal Jones. And Cal had all this history of San Juan Hill and was able to tie it in, for me, to West Indian migration and Caribbean migration, because his name is Jones, but through doing research, realized that his name, you know, that his family originated in Cuba.
Mm.
Started talking about how, you know, they started bringing free black Cubans to the U.S., specifically to New York, and making them citizens. Back then, you couldn't become a citizen without owning land.
Okay.
So they would get them deeds to land in a place called Elmsford, New York, mm-hmm. so that they could vote in the coming election for a president who was going to support and initiate the war against Spain to free Cuba and Puerto Rico.
Wow. Now,
if that's not a piece of history.
That is amazing. Yeah.
Right? That New York was using free black Cubans to get votes in place to put a president in power that was going to initiate what became the Spanish-American War.
Mm. Teddy Roosevelt?
No. This is long before
Roosevelt. Long before Teddy? Not FDR, but Teddy.
Oh, I'd have to look it up.
Yeah, I think Teddy was Spanish-American.
That's how that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And this was when Greenwich Village was black. Part of what they called Little Africa at the time. So when Carl gave me that piece of history, it changed the whole thing because it literally placed the Caribbean and explained why so many soldiers of West Indian heritage got apartments in San Juan. Because San Juan Hill, a lot of the people were veterans. Like Rashid Ali's father is a veteran.
The veteran, yeah.
So just, you know, a very multifaceted, multi-directional research. I'm reading, learning about race riots in San Juan Hill, which happened every week. And I'll never forget, you know, when I did this research, a journalist, because I was doing all these interviews to promote the show, and a journalist reached out to me because we had done an interview, and he said, you know, we're trying to corroborate some of these things, these claims.
Yes.
And, you know, we can't find anything about a riot on the 13th of July in 1905. I said, well, here it is on the cover of the New York Times, July 14th, 1905.
There you go. And he couldn't find it.
And the funniest part is the interviewer was from the New York Times.
I'm not thinking.
I was able to use their own publication.
To show that there's a riot.
And then when the article came out, it said, in the New York Times. I was like, look at that. So it's interesting that there are all these things documented.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all digitized. And so that was that part of the research. Meeting people and then digging into what music were playing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that in the 19-teens, what was piano music was happening. You have the waltzes, you have Belasco, you have Lovey String Band coming in 1912. So immediately I'm like almost like making a scene and I'm creating my own almost like cultural timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have the Charleston happening in the early 20s. And before that, you know, you have all these gullah workers coming up to work the shipyards.
Mm-hmm.
So everything makes sense. There's a time when there's a time period from when there's almost like an incubation period from when you get the facts to when it makes sense in a timeline.
Gotcha.
So I did that, and then I started writing music, you know, about each of them, about the riot, about this amazing woman named Hannah Elias, about urban removal, which is why it's no longer there.
Yeah, it's no longer there, yeah.
And I, you know, it wasn't any finger pointing, it wasn't any poverty theater, it was just the music and the films and the words of the people telling the story.
So the music inspired a kind of feeling, a kind of understanding of what the space was at that time.
But we also were able to, because of technology, utilize imagery from the actual place and juxtapose it against imagery from now so they can see what it was.
What about before and after kind
of. On top of that, we have the sounds of actual residents, the voices, them telling stories. And we even had the sound of the demolition because there was a radio show called Sounds of New York and it was led by a guy named Schwartz, who was from San Juan, he was from the neighborhood. And when an episode starts, you're listening to Sounds of New York. My name is Schwartz, and you're listening to the demolition. And he literally says, you are listening to the demolition of tenement buildings for the new Lincoln Square Arts Project. It's the actual, like, the
actual song of cranes
So I got that and put it on the turntable. I got DJ Stribble, DJ Logic to play that during the drum solo that was to represent the demolition of the buildings in urban removal.
That's amazing. It's amazing one that they recorded that, but that's a whole other story.
I didn't even find out about that until the week of the show because they had all these panels. There were these academic panels around the premiere of the performance, and one academic panel is one of the historians. She played the recording, and I was like, are you serious?
Yeah. I'm keen to know, well, of course, part and parcel of what you've done is, of course, there's always a recorded element in all your work, right? And I know in terms of your performance, you record, and then you go out and you perform and, you know, make some money, because it's still a business as it was. As I said, San Juan Hill was premiered at the the Lincoln Center, I guess it was a refurbished, what's the name of the hall?
David Geffen
Hall. The David Geffen Hall. And you, are you planning to, well, I'm assuming that you recorded it?
We recorded that performance and I'm in process of making an album right now.
When did that, 2024, hopefully?
I don't know when we're going to, I have to record the orchestra. My band's parts are already recorded. We recorded it the day after the World
Cup. Okay, got you. I got you. Yes, as I said, as you mentioned, Monk being from San Juan Hill, I know that Monty Alexander, one of your heroes, I could call him that, Jamaican jazz pianist, did an whole album.
Warrica Hill.
So that and I think your liner note writer for one of the, I want to say Creole Soul, the loop, the calypso loop. There was a specific phrase that you used, which was actually a beautiful phrase to describe the rhythm of Monk's music. I think it's Green Chimneys you were playing.
John Stevenson,
yes. And so that there is definitely a Western connection. As I said, one of the things that I had noted in terms of what you do, you don't position yourself generally as an American observer, but you consider yourself a Creole Soul, that phrase that you've created back in 2013, thereabouts, to understand that the Americas and the experience of Americans is wider than just New York City. It's wider than even San Juan Hill. It's part of a larger space.
Way wider.
Yeah, so that certainly by the time you're done San Jose Suite, you're able to capture San Jose, California, San Jose, Costa Rica, and San Jose de Aruna, Trinidad, which is now St. Joseph.
And find the connections.
Impressive, impressive, impressive. That's why we have Etienne Charles on our show today. But so you've understood it, you've found those connections, and certainly any kind of Caribbean connection within jazz. But there's other aspects of the American experience that you talked about, the journalists not seeing stuff that had already been printed in the New York Times. There's another grand episode that happened over a century ago that is, I think, one of the songs, if it's not the song, is part of your current album, Live in San Francisco, Volume 1. And that song is called, I'm saying song, that tune is Greenwood. We'll be right back. For those who don't know, Greenwood was, I think, the name of the area in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which was the Black Wall Street. Guide me through that process of that creation, because I do know that that was, aside from the event itself, that event was actually purposely tried to be removed from history. Literally, they cut out the articles that reported on it and discarded it. And it came to the prominence via some foolishness about a television program. It's one of those sci-fi films where they recreated it, and that's where a whole swath of Americans even knew that the Watchmen, that they knew it existed. And so tell me about that process, because I think Greenwood is an important continuation of your journey as a discoverer and an exhumer, I want to use that word, of an experience about Black Americans, but Black Americans in the wider Americas.
Yeah, so the interesting thing is, and thank you for doing your homework.
I tried to keep a question short, but you know, we're down a rambling.
So I was that guy, same thing during the pandemic, sitting down watching way more TV than I ever watched in my life.
Mm.
And I watched this HBO series,
Watchmen, yeah.
And in that opening scene, and you see the bombings happening, and there's this little boy. And it was the first time I had seen like a film adaptation of what at the time when it was this urban folklore about Black Wall Street. And most people didn't even know about the word Greenwood, but everybody just knew about Black Wall Street. They never hear about Black Wall Street. And so I was so intrigued. I started doing so much reading. And it was right before the 100th anniversary of Massacre. This was in around April, May of 2021. And remember, everybody's on their couch.
It's
the middle of the pandemic.
And
it's funny, I was supposed to put this on the album, me introducing the tune like I did on stage, but we didn't have enough tape to put on the record. So I literally jumped in my car and drove to Tulsa. Michigan. I drove to Tulsa.
Wow. How long is that
my
trip?
My TA, 10, 12 hours. It was a long drive.
It's in America.
I remember I had to change my alternator. So I had to leave a day later. And then I drove to Tulsa. I went there, reached out to some people, did a couple of the tours, and went to a couple of the museums and memorials, and stood in the space, stood on the corner of Archer and Greenwood, and stood in the places, stood in the church where the one church that still stands that got bombed, and stood in a room where they met for prayers that Sunday after the bombing happened.
After the massacre, I think it's now called the Greenwood Massacre.
But it was a mass bombing as well, because people don't realize that.
Americans bombing Americans.
People were flying planes over and dropping bombs.
Bombs, yes.
Okay. Which means it had to be a little more orchestrated than they say, that it couldn't have just been the spur of the moment.
It's been confirmed that the chief of police was actually deputizing individuals and saying, hold a gun.
They were... What's the word? They were appointing deputies on the spot.
On the spot, yeah. Yeah, you look like you need a gun. Go and do your work.
And we'll never really know, because they just dumped a bunch of the bodies in the river. So they'll never really have the idea of how many people were killed. And I just read, that the survivors lost their claims for reparations. And for years, because I asked so many people in Tulsa, I was like, how come y'all never talked about that? That was, our parents never told us about this.
Yeah.
We went to school, never learned about this.
It was.
And I was like, that's very similar to Trinidad. Because
there's
a lot of things in our history we don't teach our people about.
At all.
Ironically, the priest who is now the pastor at that church that got bombed, that's still standing, parents are from Trinidad.
Trinidad is everywhere, boy.
He's from somewhere in Florida. So then I go there and I get not only the storyline I want to tell of the actual event, but I get to be there and see it and kind of visualize things. So that's why the piece is kind of cinematic in nature. And then we come back at the end to the beginning, because what the most important part of the history that they don't tell is that they rebuilt Greenwood.
They rebuilt Greenwood.
And Greenwood, Oklahoma, became one of the jazz hotspots. And what people know as the Kansas City Sound, which is, Count Basie, Benny Moten, etc., is actually a Greenwood, Tulsa, Oklahoma sound. because they would go to Tulsa. And that's why I love studying history and geography together, because you see what's a close drive. Mm-hmm. And Benny Moulton, who was in Kansas City, would go to Tulsa to pick up musicians to come back and play gigs in Kansas City. And there was many Tulsa, Oklahoma-based and from musicians who ended up in Benny Moulton's band.
Yes.
And when Benny Moulton died and Count Basie took over the band, what became the Kansas City sound is actually significantly influenced by Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, I would never have known that part if I hadn't gone to Tulsa and gone to the Jazz Hall of Fame and seen how many of Basie's musicians were from Tulsa. You know, and all were from Texas, but then living in Tulsa. It's important to pay attention to the fact as well with Greenwood that at the turn of the century, Tulsa, Oklahoma had the highest income per capita in the world.
In the world?
In the world.
Wow.
At the turn of the century, Tulsa, Oklahoma, was the highest, like, the highest salary per capita in the world. Top of that, after World War I, many free black veterans went to Tulsa, Oklahoma as well. So, you know, there's this huge converging and there's all kinds of things at play. But from my research, I've realized that there's a couple of things. You have the Civil War. You have the Sons of the Confederacy. They had a huge convention, 40,000 people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, like either in the 19-teens or early 20s. And then from, and right before that, you have Birth of a Nation coming out.
Yeah.
Right? Because I always talk about life imitates art. It's not the other way around. Because before Birth of a Nation, the Ku Klux Klan had never worn white uniforms with hoods. They had never burned crosses before that movie. They saw those things in that movie.
And they just mimicked
it. And that was one of America's first blockbuster hits.
Yes, it was a big thing.
They played that movie at the White
House. At the White House, yes.
Right? So I see all those things as part of the unraveling that caused the massacre. You know, you have this huge migration from the South to Tulsa, both black and white. So I wanted to capture all of that, but then I wanted to make sure and show, yes, Tulsa rose again out of the ashes with the people who were left behind, people who survived. And they rebuilt it. And then the real destruction came when they decided to build a highway
straight through,
it, which they did all over America. They did that in New Orleans. They did that in Overtown in Miami. They did it in Tulsa, Oklahoma. They did it in the Bronx in New York.
Once is a coincidence, twice is a pattern, three times now they're doing it for something.
The code was urban renewal, which really meant urban removal. And the massacres also happened everywhere. Like between 1919 and 1921, 22, you had massacres all over. You had massacres in Chicago. You had Rosewood in Florida. You had Tulsa.
I remember,
you had massacres and riots in New York.
Yeah, I remember reading up on of course, the Tulsa massacre and discovering it as part of a series of massacres all over America. And that's part of the American history, which, unfortunately, in Florida, where you're based right now, at the University of Miami, the governor's trying to remove Black history. It's one of those kind of weird kind of coincidences.
I mean, they've already removed it from public school, but it's interesting because even with that, they're trying to remove it, but they never really taught it. So I'm like, so the people, a lot of people who are mad, they're like, well, what did we do? What did we do before? You know, like, you talking about generations of people who were not taught about the massacre in Tulsa.
Tulsa. The people there who did not know.
Generations of people in Trinidad that don't know about Campbell riots.
Definitely. Definitely.
So this is, these are the connections that I try to draw. But yeah, so that's how I dug in to Greenwood.
Is it a suite or is it just that one piece of music?
One piece of music.
One piece of music. Like about eight, nine minutes.
Normally when I perform it, it gets longer. But for the recording, we had like a short.
Yeah, like a shortening and thing. It's part of the new album, Live in San Francisco, Volume 1, which is now out on Culture Shock Records.
That's correct.
And you could get it on Etienne Charles' website. As I said, you're a discoverer and also, I call it exhumer. There's probably a better word for it. Where you find connections where other people would not necessarily find connections. And of course, that is part of your Caribbean experience, part of the knowledge if you've gone to school. And one of your albums before this one was an album called Traces, where you kind of traced journeys or you found the traces of an existence among the four musicians in your quartet. Etienne Charles from Trinidad and Tobago. Tell me the other musicians in the Traces quartet.
Vincent Segal on cello.
From
France.
Mm-hmm.
Jorge Glem, quattro from Cumaná in Venezuela.
Venezuela.
Mm-hmm. And all Barakat from Jerusalem, Israel,
mm-hmm.
by way of Argentina.
Argentina.
By way of Morocco, because he's North African Jew,
mm-hmm.
who was born in Israel, raised in Argentina,
mm-hmm.
and moved back to the U.S., moved mm-hmm. to the U.S. Now, that was one of the things. And then Vincent's family, his mother is Algerian.
Yeah, North Africa once again.
North African again, mm-hmm. right. But with European mm-hmm. bloodlines as well. Mm-hmm. Jorge being from Venezuela, a land where many of the Sephardics came to mm-hmm. during the Spanish Inquisition or after the Spanish Inquisition. Mm-hmm. So, realizing that here in the Caribbean, we have, specifically Traces was started, the idea for Traces was started by me really getting familiar with Lionel Belasco's music.
Okay.
And understanding that his father was a
Sephardic Jew. It's part of his Wikipedia page.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And understanding, but you hear the influences in his melodies, because when mm-hmm. I play Belasco's music to people who don't know Belasco, they think I'm playing Sephardic mm-hmm. music.
Okay.
So the influence is there. Mm. Kind of the same way the influence in Ruby Nichols. You know, it's like this ancestral memory is a real thing.
It's, yes.
So that's what, and then I was like, well, what were the journeys? And then you start digging and realizing, you know, that so many people left Portugal. A lot of them went to Holland. From Holland, they went to Dutch Antilles.
Curacao, yeah, Aruba.
At the time, Curacao, Aruba. Right? From there, if you look where Curacao is, you see how close it is to Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Curacao, they speak English, Dutch, Papiamento.
Yeah, Papiamento, that kind of everything in it.
Right?
Yeah.
So you realize that there are these migrations that happen. And then you see in Brazil, you have Sephardics in Brazil, like Jacob do Bandolim, who was one of the pioneers of Choro. It was really Jacob Betancourt, which is a Sephardic name.
Sephardic, Betancourt.
And so, yeah, learning the names was also very helpful for me, understanding what went into a Sephardic name, something that sounds Arabic, something mm-hmm. that refers to a location, all these different things. And that group was to explore the sound and explore these migrations. And, you know, it's one of my favorite things to do is to play that project, because it's such a warm sound. Mm-hmm. There's no drums. There's no cymbals to overpower. There's no piano to kind of control the harmony.
Mm-hmm.
And it's locked into the groove, because Jorge is so rhythmic and Aura is so rhythmic and Vincent mm-hmm. so rhythmic. We've all studied groove-based things.
Thank you.
So I'm looking forward to doing another record with them and starting to do more shows with them.
Because I it's a live album that I think you recorded in France. That one was done in France.
We recorded in Poughkeepsie, New York, at Vassar College during the world premiere of the project.
Yeah.
And then the next night in Hot Springs, Virginia, at Garth Newell Music Center.
Yeah. Was that project ever performed in Morocco or in France?
We did trio in Morocco.
Yeah, trio.
Me, Jorge, Jorge Orr and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the quartet in France. So, but now we're actively working on pursuing a proper tour.
Mm-hmm.
Because my goal is to play the music in the regions where it comes from. So Spain, Portugal, etc.
Yeah.
Look who's calling.
Wow.
One sec.
You want to take it?
Commander, how you doing?
Yes, the beauty of live podcast recording, aside from music, we also had a stop for a conversation with the immaculate Monty Alexander. But we're back talking to Etienne about his album Traces and the kind of process that he went in terms of creation, discovery, and that journey of finding roots of everybody's culture and letting that inform the music that they played. Just follow on and just see if you could wrap up the Traces conversation.
Yeah, that's basically what Traces was about, but also finding common ground between four musicians from four different countries. I mean, the clear connection between myself and Jorge, geographically, from us both being from what was once known as the Viceroyalty royalty of New Granada.
There you go.
A lot of people don't know that Trinidad was included in the Viceroyalty royalty of New Granada. Right? As in, it was all one thing, like, what is now Venezuela, Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, all that stuff, right? It was all, and Trinidad was a part of that.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm going to explore with the next project for Traces. But, and a clear links between Vincent and Orr, but then how you connect all four of us was the project that, you know, like I said, it's one of my favorites. And I look forward to digging into it again.
One of the songs on Traces is a piece of music, Guana. Am I pronouncing that properly?
Ganawa.
And yeah. I'm intrigued about that particular piece because is that you all gone to that part of Africa or was it just inspired by the heritage of your fellow musicians?
Was inspired by me traveling to Essaouira and understanding the history of Essaouira and the fact that Ganawa music specifically comes from a migration
once again
Malian captives slaves in Morocco going all the way back to like I think the 13th century or something like that.
Damn.
You know, so this is not the first time it's not the first time it's been like that.
Yeah. One of the things is, as much as we're talking almost at a cerebral level about these kind of notions of migration and colonization, among other things, the music that you create, however, is still simply listenable, some danceable. And I think that is something that listeners would have to understand and appreciate because there's something about your Caribbean DNA, that Creole soul, as you said it, that understands that music, certainly for us, has to inform, but I also believe has to entertain. I don't know if that's part of your understanding of what music is, represents. Guide me. If I'm wrong, tell me so.
I think it comes from influences and also from knowledge. One, growing up in the Caribbean and understanding that much of the music that we interact with here has a dance component. Simply because this is a place where our culture is heavily influenced by Afro-descendant creativity.
Yeah.
Now, in many parts of West Africa, music and dance are one thing. Like they don't happen separate in many instances. And of course, there are certain things that are just for this and for that. But there are many instances where it's so for me, naturally growing up in a steel band, growing up playing all these different dance styles, when I write, I'm always thinking about the music being a way to move the body, right? And so that's one of the reasons I always try to channel that, but also because I study the grooves.
Yes.
I study four grooves, and the four grooves help to inform the composition. So if I learn a folk groove to then imbibe it in a composition, and then I ignore the folk groove, and the folk groove is tied to a dance, and somehow that, so it's natural for it to feel that way. On top of that, you know, Horace Silver is one of my most influential inspirations as a composer. He has these essential elements of jazz composition. It's literally like these rules in his rule book, and he dropped them on during an interview when he was in the studio recording Serenade to a Soul Sister. And in the interview, which became in the liner notes, he said, the essential elements of jazz composition are melodic beauty, harmonic beauty, rhythm, meaningful simplicity, and environmental / familial / hereditary influences.
Boom. That's
right there.
That's your blueprint almost.
That's my blueprint. It's like meaningful simplicity is the most important one for me.
Like, I like that, yeah.
That there's a depth to what gets played and what gets heard. But it's simple enough. That, I mean, for me, meaningful simplicity is Martin Luther King. Meaningful simplicity is Malcolm X. Meaningful simplicity, all the greatest orators of our time. The reason people understand what they're saying and got their message because of that concept of meaningful simplicity. It didn't mean that their message didn't have any depth. It didn't mean that it didn't have any content. It meant that there was meaning within the simplicity.
I have to learn that. One of the things, as I said, I always come back to the album Creole Soul, probably your chart-topping album that came out in 2013, because I think that this is the 10th anniversary, I think, and you're probably going to tour on it. But it, as I said, it expanded the idea for certainly for listeners that the Caribbean is wider than Trinidad or Jamaica. You went to Haiti, as I said, you went to the French Islands. And that notion of finding all those influences, I think, was important. But as I said earlier, to me, your most important piece of music right now is Carnival Volume 1. And I know there's a Volume 2 because I heard it. But this idea of the Carnival and even earlier the Kaisu and recognizing that Trinidad folklore knowledge ties into something that you're doing practically, and something I don't know that you, one of the reasons that you're hearing Trinidad right now. And I want to kind of wrap up our conversation on the idea of rhythm, brass, and mass, and how that plays into your ethos as a composer, as a musician, as a discoverer of what Trinidad culture is and what it can be. And of course, your sojourns all over the world and seeing if that could make a space elsewhere.
I mean, I think rhythm, brass, and mass is an extension of my explorations as an artist, because if you go throughout the history of Trinbago creatives, you know, before independence, let's go up, you know, it's hard to avoid the carnival space.
Very much so.
Because it's such a powerful part of who we are. And you look at visual artists, many of them worked in these spaces during carnival. You look at costume people. Jeffrey Holder's mother was a costume maker. When I look at Jeffrey's ballets, when I look at Dougla, or any of his really signpost works, you see the carnival.
Definitely,
like,
yes.
It's there. So for me to ignore, like, you know, anytime somebody tells me like they hear a bouncing bass line in my music, I mean, that's because I grew up playing in a steel bar. That's the carnival in my work. So for me, rhythm, brass, and mass is about the return of what I call the exchange. So the exchange is me extracting or having extracted or having imbibed all of these elements from carnival and using them in my external spaces. Now rhythm, brass, and mass is a, me for a way for me to do them here on the road, you know, and to bring live music into the space again, which which as we see now you have two, three,
you have a number of bands coming out,
and their whole focus is live brass. And I think it's funny because when I started this, people said it wasn't something that people wanted. When I started this,
people said that? That people
all kinds of people said, nah, you know, they don't really like them. But, you know, you have to remember, for me, I always think about who am I talking to? Who am I listening to? I don't think about what they know, but I think, okay, well, for everything that one person says, there's going to be people that say or think the opposite. So that's the beautiful thing about living in a democracy and living in a place where free thought is encouraged. Rhythm, brass, mass is also a way for me to show the outside world what we have in Trinidad and Tobago. Because so much of my social media following, they're like, man, yeah, you know, anytime they come to my gigs in New York, they're like, man, I saw that video. Oh,
you and you document everything, both video and audio. Yes,
and I do that, for a reason. The purpose of Creole Soul TV is really to connect my...
Tell me about that, Creole Soul TV.
It's a way to connect my audiences because there's certain things I do in Trinidad that are just too expensive to do in the U.S. Mm. and vice versa. So for me to do a big band concert in Trinidad would be too expensive.
Yeah.
But for me to do a big band concert in New York is simple.
Mm.
So the video of the big band concert will get watched more by the people outside of the U.S. And then to do Folklore or Carnival, the Sound of a People, those type of large production works, is a lot easier to do in Trinidad. You have to deal with flying costumes. Like when we did Carnival in New York, we had two suitcases just for like Dan Marino and stuff like that. Wow. So there's space for being able to show both. And Rhythm Brass Mass is, you know, something also that takes me back to my childhood of being in the Savannah on Carnival Tuesday and seeing these trucks go by and seeing these men blowing the trumpet and blowing saxophone and understanding that every time we are on the road, and the reason my horn faces outwards is so that a child knows that music comes from an instrument, not a box.
Not a box, yeah.
Because if you see a box and you hear music, without any other education, you think music comes from a box. Because how else have you seen music made? Right? It's a simple phenomenon.
That, yeah.
But that's how the human brain computes.
Mm-hmm.
You see this. And you see this and this. This plus this equals this.
Yeah.
And if you don't see this, then you just think this
equals this. Only, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Without so, the, yeah.
So, and that's how erasure happens. That's literally what happened in the last 20 years of brass bands.
Mm-hmm.
They got erased by the DJ. Now, partly that's because of capitalism, partly because yeah. But for me, I was like, I'm going to show that this can work and that there's a space for it.
Are you writing music for live music on the road?
Yes, I'm releasing tunes. We have an instrumental tune that's going to be released soon called Pikong. And it's in tribute to bands like Joey Lewis, who, you know, there was a huge dance band tradition in Trinidad.
Big time, yeah.
And people would listen to the music and they would dance.
Yes.
Now people see instrumental music and they sit down. Literally the culture has changed. And so we do have an instrumental tune, kind of, you know, in the vein of Troubadours, Talk, that type of stuff. I have a tune coming with Terry Lyons, called Tabanka.
There you go.
And I have a couple other irons in the fire to come with a nice, almost like an EP of carnival music or music inspired by the carnival tradition, but not in the vein of like carnival.
Carnival, the sound of music, yeah.
This is more...
"Quote unquote carnival music."
Yes, you know, I would say it approaches the it's for the carnival niche. Also, I'm doing a concert at Queen's Hall of my interpretations of as many different road marches over the years as possible. Some stuff by all of the greats, and then putting different singers to them to get some energy behind them. I'm excited about that concert because it's kind of like an extension of what I did with Kaiso. Because on Kaiso, we had a couple of road marches in there. But now it's more of like, and to really, as an arranger, I'm a lot more mature now. I know how to use a lot more different techniques. And so to bring all that in, and also being as familiar as I am with the work of Clyde Bradley, and the, you know, understanding who were the road march arrangers back then. You know, you had, you know, the Frankie Francis's, the Rupert Nurses, the Art Dakotos, Clive Bradley, the Ed Watts, and the Pelham Goddard, the Shell Shocks, and currently the Kyle Phillips and the Kit Israel and Casey Phillips. Kyle Phillips is the producer of Pikong.
Okay.
And Kit Israel is wrote and produced Tabanka.
Tabanka.
So it's for me getting to connect with people I've known in the industry for a long time.
You have now become an elder to a certain generation of musicians.
I grew up with Kit Israel. Kit Israel is a year younger than me.
That's what I'm thinking.
It's hard for me to be seen as an elder, but for a lot of these guys, they see me different because I'm in this space outside doing touring and doing jazz and doing all these different styles of music. But for them, it's interesting to work with them because they see a different side. They see a horn player coming and put on all the horn parts in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, I sit on behind the percussion and I put it because I came up under Ralph McDonald. I came up under people and I watched them work in the studio with speed and immediately listen and know what they want to add to it quick. And I'd be like, all right, we're going to do this. So
every minute costs dollars in a studio. So, hey. It's a business you're still running. You, Etienne Charles, as I say, you're almost an industry in yourself. You now have your Creole Soul TV. You have all your merchandise, all your music is on Bandcamp. Is that correct? Or most of it?
A lot of it is on my website. And yeah, we have Bandcamp for digital.
On your website, yeah, etiennecharles.com. And his most recent album, as I said, live in San Francisco, just released, Traces. I think both are limited editions, so get them before you can. Listen, Culture Shock in 2006, Folklore, Kaiso, Creole Soul, Creole Christmas, San Jose Suite, Carnival, Song About People Volume 1, Traces, live in San Francisco. Etienne Charles is an industry, and Etienne, I want to thank you very much for being here. Just closing remarks, if you have something to tell me, just tell me one time.
So this year is the 10th anniversary of Creole Soul.
Mm.
And I'm clinching it by coming out with my 10th album next season.
10th album next season.
So 10th album is coming out. It's a big band album.
Big
it's
band.
Called Creole Orchestra.
Okay. Wait, there's a live recording or you're in the studio making this
album? We recorded it in 2018.
So you see, he has archival material he's still giving us now.
Exactly. No, no, no. I mean, you write recordings and then you release them when?
When it's time.
When you have gigs around them. So yeah. it's part of being an industry, you know, part of understanding.
Let me be selfish and ask you, when are you going to get Carnival Volume 2?
Oh, well, Carnival Volume 2 is done.
It's recorded, but when is the public going to hear it?
Soon.
Generous.
You know,
soon.
I have to do the big band album first. I have to finish San Juan Hill.
Oh, yes.
Simply because, you know, we could talk industry stuff, but...
Mm-hmm. I don't have
time. So the Carnival Volume 2 is called Theater of the Streets.
Yes.
And it's... So Carnival Volume 1 was about rhythms and sounds.
Mm-hmm.
So musical. Carnival Volume 2 is about theatrics, spoken word.
Mm-hmm.
So Midnight Robber, Black Indian, you know, because you have to organize...
Mm-hmm.
How vast our expression is here in Carnival. It's many different things.
Yes.
So, second volume is about, more about cultural vernacular, who we are, you know, our nature being. And I'm excited about it as well. You know, it has, you know, the whip devils and it ties, you know, I'll never forget, I was talking to Maria Nunes and she said, you know, people say that the sound that connects the African diaspora is the drum.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if you really look through our history, the sound that connects the African diaspora is the whip.
The whip. That's controversial. Okay.
But percussion, from a percussion standpoint, because...
But African people weren't wielding the whip, so...
But not always. But also, if you think about it, because we go back and forth about it, a lot of places weren't doing drumming. You go to certain parts of West Africa, and drumming is not a part of the ritual. You have chorus
and...
Like, you know, so... So we've been told certain things about what the African experience is. I'm like, and when you look at these masquerades, one of the main reasons you think about it is you look at all these different masquerades around the Caribbean. They always have that whip.
True, true. Etienne Charles, the excavator of information and the truth.
For me, it's not controversial. It's like you go all over the places and you see this whip being cracked by, you know, whether it's the original jab, or you go to Puerto Rico, or you go to Dominican Republic, and like literally, it's that sound.
Haiti, yeah.
Sometimes it was for martial art, and there's nothing really, I mean, maybe it's tied to enslavement, but maybe it's not, so you never know.
I get you. Etienne, once again, I want to thank you for this conversation. I mean, we could talk for more and more time, but I think critically, I was very much intrigued in getting your composition process. Your current creativity, as I said, we have your history from 2006 to currently, albums after album, and it's going to release its 10th album within its 10th anniversary season of Creole. Yeah, so thanks a lot.
Around February, March,
of
April.
24.
Creole Orchestra.
Creole Orchestra.
And I'm very excited about that because it's a big band album that ties in my aesthetic as an arranger, my aesthetic as a composer. And it's another way to bring it full circle because that's the first music that was ever played on the radio in Trinidad. Big band music.
Always a pioneer. Thank you very much for this out there, Jazz.
Thank you.
All the best. I'm Nigel Campbell and you've been listening to Island Jazz Chat. Island Jazz Chat has been a production of Jazz in the Islands magazine, powered by iRadio.tt.